Monday, the official podcast of the MERS Political Newsletter. I'm Kyle Maloney, joined by Emily Lawler, Susan Demas, John Roerink, and Summer Minnick from the Michigan Municipal League will be joining us here in just a couple minutes. We got started here a little later than I wanted to. We just got some polling numbers from Bernie Porn shows that Obama is leading Romney by 4, according to this, which is tighter than in January when Obama was leading Romney 48-40%. You make anything out of this, Susan? I think it's tighter than I thought it was going to be, but maybe we shouldn't be surprised. Obama's not hasn't really pulled away here in Michigan.
Well, it depends on the poll. I mean, in some of the polls, like the MSNBC poll, he was up by quite a bit. I mean, Debbie was up by like 20 points, so it's early. You know, it seems like he's doing really well in Metro Detroit. That's a lead I think he would definitely be happy with. He's up 53-36 in Wayne, Oakland, and Macomb. And that's where he's going to have to win this thing. But, you know, well, it depends who's enthused. I mean, is the base going to be enthused for Romney? I'm not so sure. Is the base going to be as enthused for Obama this time? Probably not as much. So, you know, elections are who shows up, and there's a long time until November, so we'll see.
Yeah, a lot of these other numbers are kind of predictable. The Tea Party people like Romney by a large number. I know, that's really amazing.
That's and then the people, right?
Right, and then the people who don't like Tea Parties like Obama, you know, the pro-choice people are with Obama, and the pro-life, I know, shocking.
Yes.
Shocking. Anyway. That's new news coming out of Epic MRA. This week, Emily, we're not going to be driving to Detroit, hopefully, as much as we had to the last few weeks.
Just
jinxed
it, you know that.
Yeah,
good, Kyle. There's more cases for her to run
down. The consent agreement will blow up or something. So we finally have some kind of consent agreement in Detroit. The grown-ups prevailed. Who ends up looking really good here?
You know, I'm not sure anyone comes out looking really good. It seems like some of the people that had the more extreme no emergency manager, no agreement with the state viewpoints, they were getting mad at Pugh by the end of this, who was kind of the champion of the, you know, the Detroit should be free caucus, I guess. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, I think Gary Brown got the votes he said he could get, which is nice. I mean, I guess he does look good in that manner, but I think the whole city council was just a circus for days on end, and public comment was a circus. The part where the board was talking was a circus. I'm not really sure who came out on top of that. So.
You know what? You know, Emily, I'm going to describe. I really do think that Snyder looks pretty good coming out of this, because what the alternative was an emergency manager in Detroit that could have turned into an explosive situation. And I think he really kind of toned down the rhetoric and prevented this from getting too explosive, taking comments out of Detroit too personally and just saying, screw it to it all. And I'm just going to put in an EM in here and I'll show you that I mean business.
I think it's a win for Snyder, but it also raises a lot of questions. I mean, there's a lot of, this is a complex agreement. There's a lot of money in there. There's still questions I have in my mind how successful this thing will actually be in the end. The state made a lot of commitment in terms of what it has to spend under that agreement. Where does that money going to come from? There's road money that's got to be spent under that agreement. Where does that come? There's some $3 million to clear title. Where does that come from? Is the legislature going to back it financially? I think there's real questions about what happens with this consent agreement and how it works and whether it's a success.
So do you think that the governor pacified too much on this?
I wonder whether they're going to be able to fiscally meet the promises they made in that consent agreement is my question.
So maybe he did a little too much to try and prevent this thing.
I think there was a big push to get a consent agreement to take it off the political table, but is it more promises that the state has made to the city that they won't meet is my question.
Well, Susan, this is a completely different consent agreement than what we saw in Inkster or what we've seen throughout the rest of the state. I mean, the city council still has some control. The mayor still has control. It's basically you guys still have the ability to make these cuts and do the financial calisthenics that need to be done. And then if you screw up, we're going to have this guy who's going to be an emergency manager. But he's not really an emergency manager. He's a project manager. When it's all said and done, aren't we kind of setting ourselves up here for possible failure?
Well, when it comes to Detroit, aren't we always? I mean, this is nothing new. Yeah, there's a lot of room for failure. Absolutely. We'll see how it goes. I think this was the best deal that anybody could strike at the time. I think it's our best hope to turn the city around, but there are many, many pitfalls that could happen here. And not the least of which is, you know, where is Mayor Bing in all this? What is his health really like? How much of a leader are we going to have? Is there a possibility that Charles Pugh is going to be taking over as mayor at some point? You know, who's going to be running for election this time around as mayor? So we got a lot of unanswered questions. We got a lot of bills to pay, and we've got a lot of people who are still extremely unhappy in Detroit.
And we've also got Public Act 4, too, Emily, that is going to be repealed. Or at least put on pause.
I don't know who gave you that information. You got a scoop there, Kyle?
I mean, but Public Act 4, though, is going to probably be put on pause here. And then what happens after that? Does that put the consent agreement into chaos?
Well, I would say that the people that have come to agreements later are safer, such as Inkster and Detroit that are operating under these consent agreements that can fall under PA 7, the Urban Cooperation Act. So when PA 4 disappears, these consent agreements still have some legal authority. I would say that communities that are under emergency managers at this point, their fate is definitely more uncertain and perhaps a little bit more in limbo. I mean, if they have no authority for however many months between when this act gets put on hold and when it's finally decided on by voters, I'm not sure how effective those people in place can be.
So. And then, I mean, there's going to be a question on PA 72. And then there's also going to be a question, John, if we do this in interim EM bill that was discussed back in January and December last year, you know, if we don't have Public Act 4, you know, we could drop into this legal chaos about whether PA 72 then is put into effect or if there is no emergency manager or fiscal, crisis bill in place. Do we need a separate bill put in? I mean, will the legislature jam through like a Senate Bill 865 or something like it?
I think it depends on what's going on at the time that the topic comes up or when it's struck down. I mean, the closer you get to an election, I would assume that the more difficult it would be for the legislature to suddenly take a court overturned Emergency Manager Act and substitute it, because there's going to be a lot more people paying attention. There's going to be a lot more nervous lawmakers. So I think that comes down to timing and all sorts of different things.
Well, I'm not sure that the courts are going to overturn this. I think that the ballot measure has a better chance than any legal action, just because, a lot of it's brought by Robert Davis, who has his own legal problems now, and then, B, a lot of the court decisions so far have been consolidated into his cases, so it seems like even the ones that were separate have been rolled into that. I don't know if they'll be necessarily tainted by just the sheer number of lawsuits that he's brought, but I think that the courts thus far have shown kind of an unwillingness to.
All right, well, very good. Well, we're going to move on then to the next part of the podcast. Summer Minnick has been here. She doesn't want to talk on Detroit, do you?
No. I mean, the only thing, if you want me to add a comment, I would say I think it's positive that we're getting to a point where hopefully we can move on, because Detroit is such a critical component to our state. Everybody knows that. Mm-hmm. I think that it's most beneficial that we get beyond the situation and Detroit and the rest of our communities can become strong and vibrant again.
Has the MML had to take any positions on the emergency manager law?
We did not when the bills went through last year. We worked very hard. We made a choice to try to make the bills as palatable as possible rather than support or oppose. So we went in, I think we had 12 amendments. I think we were successful in every single one of them. Mm-hmm. So it's pretty hard to oppose something when when the administration and House and Senate are willing to, you know, listen to your amendment issues and handle them. So we didn't oppose the bill, but did our best to try to make them workable for our communities.
Okay. All right. Well, very good. A lot of issues going on right now with local governments and so forth. The personal property tax issue is going to be coming up here in the next couple of weeks. Finance Committee Chair Jack Brandenburg is going to be taking these up in his committee. What kind of approach are you going to? He's going to be taking as he's taking hearings on this. Hell no, or we want full replacement in the Constitution now.
Well, both, I would say. We our position, we're part of the coalition Replace, Don't Erase, and our position is to support a constitutional amendment that guarantees full replacement going forward. And I think that that's the position we'd like to start from. We do have a solution. We're not just saying, no, don't do this, but our solution is, if you choose to make this policy change, here's our solution to how to handle the other side of that equation, which is strong, vibrant communities that rely significantly on this funding. But we also are taking the position of the bills in committee are going to be reflective of the administration's proposal, which does not have a replacement mechanism. So, yes, we would be opposing and will be opposing any bills that only deal with the elimination of personal property tax that don't deal with the replacement mechanism.
How concerned are you that this proposal that's out there right now, which is basically a phase-out that starts, what is it, 2016, mm-hmm. way into the future, that there could be an immediate turnaround and it would be, well, we're just going to go ahead and eliminate it now?
Well, I think all of that is possible, which is why it's something that our members are very concerned about. You know, there are some issues. As I talk to legislators and folks in the media, I say there are a lot of times as a lobbyist where you have to get your members excited about issues. This is not one of those instances. This is one of those instances where my members are calling me saying we're not as excited as we need to be about this issue. So, oh. I mean, our members are very concerned about this. They're very cognizant of what's going on. They are talking to their legislators already, and that's because it's critically important to many of their plans for long-term survival. So yes, they are very worried about that. I don't think that I'm not sure that an immediate elimination is something that would be supported by a majority in the legislatures or in the administration, because quite frankly, of the effects it would have. The one thing I will say is that I do believe the folks we've been working with in the Lieutenant Governor's office and the Speaker's office and some in the Senate are very aware of the impact that it has on communities. So I don't think there is a desire to just go in and get rid of it.
How do you replicate the distribution of personal property tax money, since it varies so greatly from one community to another as to who gets it?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's the tricky part. I mean, if this were easy, it would have been done decades ago, is my guess. But you know, part of the issue with PPT is it's been around for decades and longer than decades, and it's like a spider that's weaved a web that touches so many different things. I mean, you're talking about authorities that collect PPT, many of the TIF districts, a majority of their revenue is PPT because the districts are drawn such that they're business districts. So mm-hmm. in many cases, all of their bonding or their capital improvements are all done based on PPT collections. So you can't just calculate this city, that county. You're talking about all these different authorities and districts all over the state. And there's a lot of concern that a lot of those type of entities aren't even calculated by the state in the $1.2 billion figure. So there is a little bit of concern about how you would be able to get the money back to the places where you'd be taking it away from. Sorry, so one other thing I'll add about personal property tax is that our members don't necessarily love the tax. They don't think it's the best revenue stream. That's certain. They would like to get rid of it as well. The issue is just the state controlling the money versus the locals controlling the money. And when you look at our history, we have a zero success rate of the state keeping its promises that prior legislators and governors committed to.
Zero is pretty hard.
It's zero. Find one single instance, and when you talk about municipal funding, where they have committed, they have kept that statutory commitment. There isn't one. And so for us to go into that, I mean, that's why there's so much concern about, oh, trust us. In 2016... when the revenue needs to go back, the new 50-some members of the House will keep that commitment.
Let's move to metrics a second. The governor has obviously...
Popular
term? Yeah, right. The governor has obviously attached what is, I guess, formally known as statutory revenue sharing to a series of metrics. How many of your members have actually complied with those metrics and are going to be able to get this new statutory?
Well, most of the communities who qualify for EVIP, which is mostly cities, villages, and there are still a few dozen, I think, townships. are qualifying for the money so far. I think the big hiccup we're going to have is in this third category on employee compensation, where we know from talking to many of our members, some are choosing not to comply, others find it too complicated to comply. And so I think we're going to see a big drop off in the compliance with this third category.
And what is the third category?
This has to do with employee compensation. So there are metrics regarding multipliers for your pension, your health care benefits, and parameters regarding all the employee compensation components. And there, many of our communities are telling us that they have made a lot of progress and are getting closer to some of the goals that are laid out in EVIP, but it's disingenuous to say, oh, because this year essentially you just have to sign a letter saying your intent is to get to these figures and produce some sort of a plan on how you plan to get there. Well, a lot of communities are saying, if I just settled with my unions and say I'm at a 1.9 multiplier and I need to be at 1.6, I'm not going to sign this and say, wink, wink, I'm going to get to 1.6, because then I'm being disingenuous, and how does that affect my negotiating with the unions? Mm. So, you know, they don't want to box themselves in by signing something, even though it says intend, which is sort of a soft commitment, mm-hmm. Because they're afraid it boxes them in with their employees and with the citizens, who will look at them and say, hey, you said that you were going to be here, and say in 6 months they can't get there. What happens then?
How many of your communities is this impacting? 30%, half, 75%?
Well, a majority of cities and villages still qualify for EVIP, so it's a significant majority of our members.
And so if they say that, if they're not going to sign this and say that they intend to get there on the economic employee piece, will they not get these EVIP payments in the future?
They will not get a third, because okay. The way EVIP works, it's essentially all of what you would have gotten last year minus a third, because they cut $100 million from $300 million initially. So you take that amount, divide it up in thirds. If you qualify for the first, if you qualify for the second, if you qualify for the third, you get it all. They've been paying it, you know, as if everyone's going to qualify. But what will happen is you won't get your third in the last couple of payments. So I just want to make one more comment about the third category, too. I think one of the reasons why we've been working really hard with the General Government Appropriations Committees in the House and Senate right now on the current budget on the third category is because there's also a lot of confusion. And I think when this came out, you know, the League didn't oppose going to this EVIP framework because a lot of our members supported going in this direction, and they had no problem with the dashboards. They have no problem with the consolidation. They've been doing consolidation. So, you know, they weren't really concerned about this. They thought, hey, you know, we're team players. We're going to do this. But the administration said that they weren't going to commit any additional resources to this, if you recall, when it passed, and said we're not going to grow state government in this huge bureaucracy. Well, the problem has been there are so many questions about the details of these categories. As you can imagine, every community's pension agreement is different. And so you have 500 communities, you have, you know, 1,000, 2,000, 3,000 different pension plan agreements. And so there's been all these questions that we've been getting, the Treasury's been getting, that we're not getting any responses to because they don't have the manpower to handle all the confusion that has come from that third category. So that's another problem that we've been raising that I'm hopeful that we'll get some changes for next year on that category, because while it was well-intentioned, you know, it's such a complicated issue that it's become quite a bit of a mess.
Wow. As far as consolidation goes, it seems like folks in Lansing are very excited about consolidation and trying to merge governments because we have too much local government. How much local government consolidation are we really seeing out there?
A tremendous amount. I think the only pushback we got from that second category regarding consolidation and cooperation wasn't the idea of supporting it. It was the idea of, well, wait a minute, I've been doing this for 10 years. Don't I get credit for the last 10 years? Mm-hmm. Especially, you know, some of the communities that are you know, under more dire fiscal conditions, they've had to. Because when you're facing, you know, significant budget shortfalls, the last thing you want to do is lay off cops and firefighters. So you know when you're getting to that point, they've exhausted those other areas. You know, they've done joint purchasing. They've done joint agreements on parks and rec and other things of that nature. So when you see those type of reductions in communities, that's typically a sign that they have really gone after all the low-hanging fruit regarding consolidation and cooperation.
Could Michigan survive without townships, and if we got rid of them, would we save some money?
I'm sure Michigan could survive without townships. I guess the question would be, what does that look like? Because clearly there are many urban townships in the state that function like cities, and you know they aren't just going to go away, and they shouldn't just go away. There are important communities across the state. So, you know, there are other states that don't have that form of government, but what you do on the flip side of that, I guess, is the answer to that question. I think that, you know, there are a lot of other states that it's, you know, I don't want to say urban, but the developed area, the city, and then the county or the town. You know, all of those states, they have towns. So certainly it can be done. But the question is, what would you do in a state that has developed them for, you know, 100 and some years to the point where they function like cities? I mean, clearly, you know, something would have to be done with that.
Couldn't our cities and counties take over most of those communities, though, in terms of the services they provide? And
well, there's a could and there's a should. I mean, you know, when you look at local government consolidation, some of the biggest pushback isn't from the local leaders, it's from the citizens. And so, you know, I'm not sure if, you know, everybody in Meridian Township would be happy to be living in the city of East Lansing or the city of Lansing. So I think that, you know, and would it save any money? Now, certainly there's probably some efficiencies that could be made in any type of consolidation. But, you know, local government is a service provider. That's what we do. We don't make widgets. And providing services takes people and takes time. And so, you know, can you reduce the number of police that you have by consolidating? I mean, those are the questions, you know, or do you still need X number of police per population? And so combining those, I don't know, you know, there's questions about that.
All right. Well, very good. Summer Minnick from the Michigan Municipal League. Thanks for joining us on our podcast this week.
Yeah.
Emily Lawler, Susan Demas, and John Rurink. That's going to do it for this week's edition. Thanks to the Michigan Press Association for sponsoring the podcast. The Ghost is Dancing for doing the music this week. We are going to find new music, Emily. Don't
yeah,
sweat.
We're on a search.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to make you the chair of the search committee for new music. You can find new music. That's fine.
Oh.
I'll link. That's okay. I mean, I like this song, but I'm not like wedded to it. Okay.
Okay.
All right. So see what you can do. Bring some proposals.
Okay.
You know, get a committee together. That's how things are done here in Lansing. And give me some proposals. Also, thanks to Rita for sending this out on Constant Contact. And until next week, I'm Kyle Moore. Take care.